Hey there, folks. This guy backing up or not? I hope not. This is Rish Outfield, and you are listening to the Rish Outcast. It is May 2022, and it is time for the third part of my presentation of Newfound Fame. I recorded the first episode in March, the second episode in April. And so I held off on the third episode so that it would be in May. Doesn't accomplish anything to do them a month apart. But, hey, it gave me time to edit. That was kind of nice. This is the final section. Third, I guess you can say. I hope that you have enjoyed the ride so far, and that you like my writing, you like this story, you like Ernst Hillerman, you like the premise, you like my narration, you like me.
Everyone in this room is now dumber for having listened to it.
Anyhow, I guess I will just let you go, then we can talk more afterward.
11. Ernst and Alonzo Moss went back to the table, where there were still about 10 autograph hounds waiting, a couple of them kids under 10. Before seeing the unwanted presence, Ernst would have marveled at this, that children were even at this thing, let alone knew who he was. But now he didn't care that they were here, that they were dressed as zombies, that they wanted him to sign their programs. Moss dialed a number and spoke softly into the phone. Far enough away, Ernst couldn't hear what he was saying. It didn't matter whether he believed him or not, really.
"Thanks for coming," Ernst said to the children as they left.
The brown depths monster still waited, right there where it had first appeared, still waiting, still watching, apparently incapable of getting bored.
"How many times have you seen the movie?"
Ernst asked the next lady in line. She had to be at least 50, maybe older. Her hair was so red and so youthful, it had to be a wig.
"Oh, I don't know. A dozen times, I suppose. It's good stuff."
"Is it?" he said. "And do you remember if the monster I played had any weaknesses?"
"Oh, you seemed quite strong," the wigged woman answered. "The way you broke that boy's spine?"
Ernst interrupted.
"No, like sunlight or holy water or that sort of thing. The monster's weaknesses."
"Oh, none that I recall. I thought I knew the movie pretty good. What is it?"
"I don't know either. Just asking."
That would have been nice, if it had been afraid of fire, or the cross, or anything, maybe a Bible. But it didn't look like Ernst was going to get very lucky today.
"Is that Alonzo Moss?" the lady asked. "He's the one that found you?"
"That's right. He tracked me down. Let everybody know who I was. If not for him, I'd have been forgotten."
"Well, I ought to thank him, too. Gonzo's really doing good work spreading the word about the Brown Depths. If not for him, I never would have known about the movie. And now, look."
She held up a copy of the Blu-ray.
"Yeah, I..."
And then Ernst saw the monster move. It wasn't looking at him anymore, but was looking at Alonzo Moss.
"Anyway, thanks for being so friendly,"
the woman went on, unaware he was no longer paying her any attention.
"And cheap. You know that asshole from the Evil Dead movies wants $50 an autograph?"
"Alonzo,"
Ernst said, raising his voice. The businessman put up his finger, asking for a moment. He kept talking into his phone.
"Mr. Moss!"
And Alonzo Moss actually took several steps away from Ernst, so as to have a little privacy. The creature walked in that direction, leaving Ernst and the red-wigged woman alone. It was just like that moment in the film where Ernst himself had left the two main characters alone to go after the tow truck driver, who had been by himself. Stupid that he was remembering that now, but maybe not totally stupid.
"Ma'am," Ernst said to the lady, "thanks for coming. I'll be happy to talk to you some more, if you can just excuse me for a moment."
He pushed back his chair, more gently this time, and stood up.
"Oh no, thank you,"
the lady said, and took her signed Blu-ray and put it back in her bag. Ernst walked toward Moss, who had gone into the corner where a couple of empty tables sat, their celebrity owners having gone home for the day. Ernst heard him saying,
"I hate to turn people away at the door, but tomorrow will be even worse. Maybe put some kind of express lane for people who can pay in cash?"
Ernst reached Alonzo before the creature could, which, again, just like the movie, was slow and stiff, having been rotting for so long underwater.
"Mr. Moss," he said.
Moss made an irritated face and said,
"Shonda, I've got to go. I'll call you back."
He turned off his phone and put it in his pocket, turning to face Ernst. Before he got there, he had already put on a pleasant, jovial face. His businessman face.
"Yes, Mr. Hillerman."
"You're probably going to think I'm crazy when I say this," began Ernst, but was interrupted.
"Oh my God,"
Alonzo Moss said. He was looking beyond Ernst, to the creature that was now standing only 10 yards or so away, watching them, swaying in that way it had. Ernst let out a stressful breath.
"Okay, maybe not so crazy."
"That costume is insane!"
Moss all but shouted. He grinned big.
"Did you see that?"
Ernst didn't glance over. He was all too familiar with the creature's appearance. Moss went on.
"Why, he doesn't look anything like you did in the movie, but I've got to admit, it looks better."
"Better, yeah," Ernst said, sighing. "Look, only you can see it. You and me, I mean. And that's bad."
"Bad? Why would you think it's bad? I mean, look at the eyes, the way they..."
And Moss stopped talking, his mouth staying partway open. It had taken him a couple more seconds than Ernst to realize what he was looking at.
"They,"
he said at last, and closed his mouth.
"Now you can see why I was so nervous before," Ernst said.
And this was really strange, but he felt a bit better knowing he wasn't the only one.
"It's real,"
Moss muttered.
"It, all the talk, the stories."
"Apparently."
Moss kept staring at it.
"What does it want? Did it say anything to you?"
"It didn't say anything. Just stood there, watching. I was pretty sure I was what it wanted."
Ernst shot the thing a quick look.
"Now it's us."
"Us? But what did we do?"
The businessman raised his voice so the monster could hear.
"To be honest, I've never even been to North Carolina."
"Congratulations," retorted an actor named Ken a couple of tables away. Once, he had played the black guy from Dawn of the Dead.
"None of them can see it?"
Alonzo Moss thought aloud.
"Just you and me?"
"As far as I know."
"Why?"
"I think, I can't say why, but I think we see it because it's marked us somehow. It wants us to see it."
"Why?"
asked Moss again. The answer was obvious.
"So we'll be afraid."
Moss nodded slowly. The plan was definitely working.
"But how is that possible? That nobody else sees it's there?"
"How is any of this possible?"
Ernst asked. And he must have raised his voice, because several attendees craned their heads to look at him.
"What I mean is, none of the actors in Godzilla movies ever see Godzilla chasing them around. That we know about."
Moss did not laugh.
"All those accidents and suicides and disappearances," It was that thing.
Ernst had had hours to contemplate that. Well, it figures that some of those suicides might actually have been suicides, to get that thing to leave them alone.
I'm calling security. Maybe they can tase it or pepper spray the bastard.
Ernst pondered this. He didn't think it would work, but it was worth a try. Moss sighed.
No, I can't do it. This will ruin my reputation. Nobody will work with me again if they think I've lost my mind.
Ernst made no reply. It would have been too insulting. And then the old man saw another unusual sight that caught his eye. There was a priest walking past a 3D printing booth across the way, in the standard frock and collar. He even had a cross around his neck. It seemed hard to believe, but maybe someone was looking out for him.
Alonso, come with me, he said, and started moving toward the stranger. I think someone can help.
They moved quickly through the crowd, which had thinned quite a bit from earlier in the afternoon, but was still plodding and hard to navigate through. For a moment, Ernst had lost the priest in the hustle and bustle of convention attendees, but there he was, examining a vendor's creepy moving photographs.
Excuse me, Father,
Ernst said, tapping the man gently. The priest turned around, and Ernst was off-put by the discovery that he had green goo all over his shoulders and hair.
Me? Yeah?
The priest asked. He was young, ostensibly too young to actually be a priest.
I began Ernst, then shook his head, feeling like an idiot. You're not really a priest, are you?
The young man laughed, and Alonzo Moss said,
He's Father Karras from The Exorcist, Ernst.
Ernst put two and two together. The green goo was supposed to be pea soup. Hilarious.
Never mind. Sorry to bother you.
Did you think I was a real priest?
The youth asked, chuckling. Ernst and Alonzo stepped away from him. As they went, the priest called out,
The power of Christ compels you!
Everybody's a fucking comedian, Ernst thought aloud.
They were surrounded by congoers, and Ernst simply stopped in his tracks, letting the people move around him. They were taking pictures of the costumes, of displays, of themselves, and standing among them, like a river of slowly rolling human water, Ernst felt safe from the creature. A respite. A moment later, an announcement came over the speakers. It was hard to make out, but it was repeated three times. The convention floor would be closing in 20 minutes.
Why so early?
He asked. It was a horror movie, Halloween thing, after all.
Well, it's still Utah,
Moss said in his ear. They slowly turned, heading away from the crowd, back to Celebrity Corner. Moss's cell phone began to ring in his pocket, but he just let it ring. The Brown Depths monster was standing beside a mask vendor booth, still waiting. Ernst gritted his teeth as they walked past it, but it didn't make any aggressive moves.
Why doesn't it just kill both of us?
Asked Moss. Ernst shushed him, or tried to, anyway.
Don't give it any ideas, man.
I'm serious. It's something that didn't make sense in the movie. We've both seen it now. We've both upset it for some stupid reason. There's nothing stopping it from just walking over here and murdering both of us.
Ernst knew that was true, but it didn't seem to be in the monster's wheelhouse.
It must have some rule about that.
They kept walking back to Ernst's booth.
Oh, I know, he said. It was intended as some kind of corollary between the dead kid it used to be and us. He had been alone, and so are its victims. But it just doesn't make any sense.
Most of the celebrities had stopped signing, or had gone home outright. Two fans were still in the Ernest Hillerman line. Ernst gave them a nod.
Maybe it doesn't want to draw attention to itself.
throw more light on the curse.
Okay. But it certainly could have killed you and me in the bathroom before, without too many people seeing or knowing about it. You could have drowned in that urinal, the same way the webmaster that pissed it off did in his tub.
Gross.
Ernst thanked the two remaining fans for waiting, and signed their poster and t-shirt, respectively. Moss stood nearby, but would not sit down. As the fans walked away, Ernst said,
"It wants us to be afraid. Don't you get that sense from it?"
"I do,"
Moss said, looking at the thing just standing there, dripping phantom silt onto the floor next to an overfull garbage can.
"Could we just talk to it? Let it know what our intentions were, that we're sorry."
Ernst looked over at it too, its ember eyes unblinking.
"Somehow, I don't think it would listen, or can even make that decision on its own."
"What do you mean? That it's a puppet? Controlled by a magic spell from 200 years ago?"
Ernst didn't know.
"That makes sense to me."
Moss studied it, the way it swayed, oh, so patient.
"No, I think it enjoys killing people."
"Enjoys it? It could just be, I don't know, an animal acting on instinct, or stuck like a ghost, a miserable ghost that haunts a house."
Ma shrugged.
"Maybe. But why does Michael Myers stalk his victims? Or Jason Voorhees at Camp Blood? They enjoy it."
"I'm going to admit something to you,"
Ernst said, damning the consequences.
"I don't get horror movies. I don't get why people watch them, why they like being scared, or why they would ever watch one of those masked killer movies like you're talking about, or watch more than one of them, since they're all the same."
Alonzo Moss seemed to consider that.
"You sound like my ex-wife. We watch them because they're familiar. There's a formula and we respond to it. It's like a mystery novel or a romantic comedy. It's predictable, but that's how we like it. Comfort food."
"Somehow, I'm not very comforted right now."
Moss chuckled, in spite of the situation.
"I'm not trying to be funny, Moss."
"I know you're not. That's why I'm laughing."
The announcement came again. The show floor was closed. All attendees were to leave at any of the exits and come back tomorrow at 9 o'clock. A couple of the overhead lights went off, not enough to make anything dark, but enough so as to be noticeable.
"What now?" Ernst asked.
Moss's cell phone began to ring again, and he made no move to answer it.
"We don't need to leave. We work here. But eventually, you and I will have to go. Everybody else will, and then..."
Moss trailed off.
He didn't have to finish his sentence. "What about security guards or something? Won't they be here all night?"
"Yes, but I think there's two of them guarding this whole place. This floor is the size of 4 football fields.
"So?"
"So there's no way that thing won't consider us alone with that much space between us."
"It doesn't work that way,"
Ernst said, and put up his hand when Moss started to argue.
"Or it would have just killed me in the bathroom when it was just us two."
"It was in the bathroom when we went in there? How close was I to it?"
"Real close. Guess you weren't a target then."
"So you think we'll be safe if we stay with each other? All huddled together like Hansel and Gretel?"
"We could go in the bathroom and find out."
An announcement came over the intercom overhead. The attendees were to clear out. And could Alonzo Moss please call the main office?
"You in trouble?" Ernst asked.
"Probably. I was supposed to meet with Dan. Go over the schedule for tomorrow."
"You're gonna go?"
"I think they can do without me for one evening. This is more important."
Ernst tried to smile, but his face was tired.
"You know, you're all right, Alonzo."
You are forgetting that you're marked for death because of me.
Ernst purposely didn't look away from his new friend.
Kind of hard to forget, actually.
Within half an hour, everything had quieted down. Most of the vendors had closed up their wares, leaving things for the next morning, and security had ushered any lollygaggers to the exits. Alonzo and Ernst had walked the show floor, trying to stay around other people, but soon there weren't any people to stay around. Two security guards had approached them, separately, trying to get them to leave, and Alonzo had explained who he was and that it would be all right to leave them be. But soon his cell phone began to ring, and he winced when he looked at it.
"More trouble?" asked Ernst.
"Not trouble. They're just concerned. My boss wants me to call him back ASAP. Or at least he did 3 calls ago."
Ernst looked across the convention floor, where many booths were covered up by curtains or tarps. Many of the lights had been turned off, and it had an abandoned feel to it. A ghost town. And speaking of ghosts, the Brown Depths monster stood beside the Ghostbusters car, getting spectral drippings onto its front bumper. Ironic, maybe, but not at all amusing.
"What are we going to do?"
Alonzo shook his head.
"If we get out of here, it'll just follow us."
"Like in the movie," guessed Ernst.
"Like in the movie,"
Alonzo said quietly. A security guard approached them. He had a flashlight on one side of his belt, and what might have been a pistol on the other. He wore a name tag that read Oliver, but the O had been worn or scraped off.
"Still here, you two? Anything wrong?" "Wrong?"
Moss asked.
"No, nothing wrong." "Well, I really am supposed to clear this area." "Was supposed to before. You're the only ones left."
"We could stay with you,"
Ernst suggested.
"Keep you company."
The security guard squinted at him.
"Here? Here on the convention floor?" "Why not? Help you pass the time,"
Moss said.
"I appreciate that. I really do. But you two ought to get on your way. My boss is going to ask if anything out of the ordinary happened. And, well..."
Moss pretended not to understand what the man was saying.
"Oh, I bet you have some great stories, doing what you do. Love to hear them."
"Yeah,"
Ernst said.
"Mr. Moss,"
the security guard said, squaring his shoulders,
"I'd really be grateful if you two left for the night. Leave me to my duties. We can talk tomorrow, surely, if you want to come by at 8.
"It really sounds like he wants us out of here, Ernst,"
Moss said, and though he was good-humored about it, there was just a tinge of sharpness to his voice.
"What do you think?"
I suppose we'd better. Is your car parked nearby? Maybe we could go for a quick drive. Someplace where we could go fast."
Alonzo nodded.
"That might work. Yeah, let's..."
He glanced over past the security guard.
"Let's do it."
The man walked them over to where one of those sliding metal gates had been brought down, and squatted, unlocking it. Both Ernst and Moss turned to watch the Brown Depths creature stalking toward them, moving slowly, as though it were still in waist-deep water.
"What's your name?"
Alonzo asked the guard as he began to raise the gate.
"Oliver, but they call me Liver."
"Liver?"
Alonzo Moss somehow managed to sound casual. Ernst was mildly impressed under the circumstances.
"Can you pull this back down as soon as we're under? Lock it up immediately?"
I guess. What's this about?"
The creature was getting closer, but still a good 20 feet away.
"I'll explain later, okay? Hey, we really appreciate this."
The gate was only halfway up, but Moss and Ernst slid underneath it, Ernst's knees complaining to him as he basically did his first squat thrust in 50 years.
"Okay, down, down,"
Moss all but shouted once they'd cleared it. Ernst used his big fingers to pull down the gate, and it banged into place with a resounding clang. The security guard seemed really nervous now.
"Guys, is this a game?"
"Lock it up again, please,"
Moss said, seeing the creature nearing the barricade, but pausing there.
"You know, I'm probably going to have to call this in," said Liver the guard.
"Sure, call it in. Just lock it."
And he did. It occurred to Ernst, though it made little sense, that he had left the framed painting the fan had made for him. Set it down on a trash can before the guard had approached them. Well, it was gone now.
"Run for it?"
Ernst asked quietly.
"I say run for it,"
Alonzo Moss agreed, and they jogged down the hall to the back of the convention center, where the entrance to the parking garage was. Ernst was barely able to keep up, his footfalls echoing off the walls around them, sounding like a Clydesdale in a subway tunnel. The exit door was locked. While Moss fumbled in his pants for his wallet, he had a pass card to unlock the door there. Ernst looked anxiously behind him. The Brown Depths monster was in the hall, gradually coming their way, its red eyes glowing brighter than the exit signs. The barricade had not held it, hadn't even slowed it down.
"Come on,"
Alonzo said, quite unnecessarily, pushing open the door and sliding through it as soon as it was barely open. Ernst was a much bigger man, so he struggled a bit getting through, then found himself in the parking garage lobby, where the check-in gate was, but no cars.
"Upstairs,"
said Moss, and started in that direction. Ernst and Alonzo moved through the stairwell, their footfalls clanging on the metal steps as they rose. It was a narrow, claustrophobic space, going up for 5 levels. Alonzo paused and looked back down, not seeing the creature, but doubting the locked garage door would stop it. It was bad that the thing made no noise. It moved silently wherever it went, unlike in the movie, where it had made a groaning sound that was, frankly, pretty damned scary. Though it now crossed his mind to ask Ernst if he had actually made those noises for the recording, it was a question for another time. Ernst kept moving, pushing those big legs of his past Alonzo and on up the steps.
"What floor?"
he asked, breathing heavy.
3rd,
said Alonzo, and then paused again. His cell phone was ringing in his pocket. He pulled it out and glanced at the screen. It was his boss yet again. He cursed, put the phone back in his pocket, and looked up the stairs. Ernst was gone, having turned the corner, those big footfalls above him now. Something grabbed Alonzo's ankle. He looked down just in time to see a mossy skeleton's hand gripping his leg, reaching up from under the stairwell, and then it yanked. Alonzo Moss was flipped backward, his leg bones snapping in the iron grip of the Brown Depths monster, and then he was falling, his back slamming against the metal stairs, bouncing and sliding down to the bottom. Above him, Ernst had already stopped on the stairwell and was turning back when he heard the man's cry and the sound of the impact.
"Moss!"
he called, and ran down again to where the steps turned the corner. Half a floor down, the businessman was on his back, one leg still up in the air, writhing in pain. His eyes were big and afraid, and he reached for Ernst. Ernst took one more step in his direction, his hand reflexively reaching out as well. And then the creature was there, coming up the steps and around the lower corner, and Ernst froze. The creature slowly, painstakingly brought a dripping foot down on Moss's neck. The crunch was sickeningly loud and resounded in the stairwell, and Alonzo Moss's movements abruptly stopped. Ernst's breath caught in his chest. He was motionless, like a terrified statue on the stairs. But the creature's unnatural head angled in his direction, those red eyes fixing onto him, and Ernst turned and ran up the steps as fast as his big legs would carry him. He didn't look back, because he knew what he would see. It following, perhaps reaching for him, perhaps just inches away. Or maybe it wasn't following. Maybe it was finishing off Moss and had not yet started its pursuit. Either way, there was no reason not to run. Ernst emerged on the third floor and saw three cars parked nearby. One was bound to belong to Moss, but it didn't matter now. He had no keys. There were no other people around, and Ernst made his way, his breathing heavy, past the cars and near the elevator in the middle of the parking garage. He nearly went for it, but either it would require a pass card like Moss had used to access the stairwell, or Ernst would get in it and be trapped in there. Somehow it seemed all too likely the monster would be waiting for him when he got out on the first floor. Though he could get out on the second floor. It wouldn't be expecting that, right? Still, the thought that he'd be in a little elevator by himself, just waiting for those doors to open, it was more than Ernst could stomach. No, he kept running, all the way across the garage, passing one more car with a security company logo on the door, but no occupant, to the stairwell on the far side. He was worried the door wouldn't open for him, but apparently once you were inside the parking garage, they didn't lock you in. His chest hurt and his breath was tight as he wrenched the door open. The stairwell was identical to the one he'd come out of, and he made his way down as fast as he dared. It was easy to imagine the creature waiting for him around each corner, or bursting through the door to the second floor the exact moment Ernst neared it. But that didn't happen. The ground-level door opened onto another part of the convention center, and right before him was a door that led outside. Ernst did dare a glance behind him as he went to the exit. Nothing. He left the building, stepping out into the night. There were people still walking about, a couple of them dressed in scary costumes, enjoying the rest of their evening. Ernst stood by them, catching his breath, feeling the sweat roll down his cheeks and neck and back. "Hey, buddy, you okay?" a kid asked him. He was dressed, believe it or not, like Michael Jackson in the old Thriller video.
"Think so. Just old."
"I hear you. We just had my dad's 50th birthday party."
The kid said it without a trace of irony. Ernst wiped at his forehead and opened his mouth to respond to the boy's comment when he saw the brown depths creature walking down the sidewalk toward him. Its eyes glowed brightly, but nobody even glanced its way.
"What, you from around here?"
Ernst asked the Michael Jackson fan.
"Sort of. Going to college up in Logan. Down for the show."
"Where can I go around here to be around a lot of people?"
"Right now? What for? Like a touristy place?"
"Sure, I don't have a car, but..."
"Oh," the boy said, pointing. "You can go to Temple Square. It's like the Mormon headquarters. Just two or three blocks up that way. Lots of tourists go there, look at the lights, see, I don't know, the Mormon Tabernacle Choir concerts and stuff."
Ernst looked up the block, the other side of the big convention center.
"Right up there."
The boy pointed again.
"Yeah, maybe two streets up. You'll see it when you get to the end of the block, if you like that sort of thing."
Actually, that sort of thing sounded pretty good to him right then. Ernst started forward, not quite running, but not quite walking either. Temple Square was a huge, city block-sized estate surrounded by a wall like some kind of castle or drug cartel's compound. It was brightly lit, and there were young women in their Sunday best standing at every entrance. Like higher-class Walmart greeters.
"Welcome to Temple Square,"
one of them said to him as he went inside, following a husband and wife that must have had seven kids with them, maybe eight.
"We close up at 9.
a second Walmart greeter said when Ernst went past. There were white Christmas lights in all the trees, and recorded angel voices came from sporadic speakers. It actually calmed Ernst down a little bit, which was welcome. It struck him that maybe the monster, if it was there due to black magic or devilry, wouldn't be able to enter a place like this, like that basilica in New York or Vatican City. That would be nice, too. All the visitors to the premises kept surprisingly quiet, even though they were outdoors, and even though every group had between 2 and 100 children with them. So Ernst was able to relax and think about things. Why hadn't he asked Alonzo, who seemed to be practically an expert on the Brown Depths monster, if all he had to do was survive until morning? That's what those well-meaning fans had said. But what if this cruel chase was everlasting? What if he somehow managed to stay around people all the time, though he probably couldn't do that unless he was institutionalized almost immediately, and that seemed like as not. And every day that damned creature was following him, watching him, biding its time. It would drive him out of his mind to live in a permanent state of paranoia and dread. Or more than likely, it would drive him to suicide. Which seemed better than spending his days and nights always looking behind him, seeing that thing still there, still waiting for him to slip up and find himself alone. Like he had on the stairs back there. He didn't know what had happened exactly, but he hadn't stayed side by side with his friend, and now Alonzo Moss was dead. Could have just as easily been Ernst Hillerman lying there, one leg on a stair, one leg twisted beneath him, hands extended, probably not discovered until tomorrow morning. A handsome young couple, white as a winter mountaintop, walked past Ernst, their arms around one another. Ernst let his eyes follow them, their lives just beginning, so much hope and optimism and contentment radiating off them. What he wouldn't trade for a chance to be in their shoes, and not just to have a death curse lifted from his head, but to be youthful once again. The Brown Depths monster was standing on the sidewalk to the left of the lovers. It wasn't watching them, but those fiery eyes were fixated on him. It should have come as no surprise, but Ernst had thought maybe a holy place like this would offer some protection, some respite. Ernst turned and followed a Spanish-speaking family as they walked around the grounds, chatting amongst themselves in hushed tones. They walked into what looked like a chapel, and Ernst also went in, where a children's choir was singing what sounded like Christmas hymns. Or maybe all religious music sung by kids sounds like that. He sat on a pew, right behind the Hispanic family, and bowed his head. He hadn't prayed in a long, long time. Couldn't remember the last time, in fact. But this felt like the place for it. As if in answer to his prayer, the song ended, and an old man came to the pulpit and thanked everyone for coming, wishing them a good night. People started to rise, including the family in front of him.
"Why did you even sit down?" he muttered, and stood up himself.
His legs felt weak from his earlier exertion, though he'd been sitting on his duff most of the day. He exited the building and stayed with the crowd. An announcement went over all the speakers that Temple Square would be closing in 10 minutes, and most everyone in the group he was with walked toward the gates that led to the street. There were Walmart greeters standing by the gates, thanking folks for coming, but escorting them out of the square. Ernst looked behind him, seeing the creature among the crowd of families in their Sunday best, its eyes visible among the smiles and twinkling lights. He slipped out the gates, thanking one of the young ladies that thanked him for coming by, and stayed with a family as they made their way down the street. Already the crowds were thinning, except for around the church. On a Friday night in the city. Many of the crowd got on a sort of train that stopped in the middle of the street, loading to the brim with passengers, leaving Ernst with a family of only 5, a rarity in Utah, it would seem. He stayed with them, though not too close,
having noticed them glance at him suspiciously a time or two when he didn't keep his distance, as they walked down the street two more blocks. The creature followed. A big blue Suburban was parked on the curb, and the family, to the last, piled inside it, leaving Ernst all alone on the sidewalk. But not alone. The monster was standing there too, a few yards away, watching, but not moving forward. Ernst considered running after the Suburban, asking them if he could bum a ride, heck, pretending he had a gun to force them to take him with them. But the light at the corner was turning yellow, and the vehicle sped up to make it in time. Now it was just Ernst and the creature. He wanted to make a run for it, but part of him just wanted to stop, to tell the godforsaken thing to do its business and get it over with. But it hadn't moved forward. It still stood there, observing, endlessly patient. Why? It didn't make any sense.
What are you waiting for, huh? He muttered.
Then, slightly louder, he yelled,
What do you want?
There came a grunt from behind him. Ernst turned to see a shape just beyond the bushes.
I don't want nothing, a male voice said.
There was a homeless man there, sitting on a folding chair, wrapped in a dirty army blanket. He had a scraggly beard and wore one of those Canadian winter hats. What did you call them? Takers or something?
Oh, sorry,
Ernst said to the man, peeking back at the monster. It hadn't moved. The homeless guy was the only thing keeping Ernst alive.
Hey there, said Ernst, putting a smile in his voice. You, know this area pretty good?
Huh? What's going on?
Ernst didn't look back again, though he was tempted to. He faced the stranger.
I'm not from around here. Do you know if there's a place I can go? Some place that never closes, where there will be lots of people all night long?
The man sighed and paused before finally saying,
There's a disco, or whatever you call it. Not far from here. The hotel.
Called the hotel or in a hotel?
Yeah, that's its name. It's just down the road, like two blocks, maybe three.
The homeless man raised a surprisingly clean hand and pointed. Ernst squinted over to where he was indicating and saw a brightly lit street, but no people. Even though they were in a fair-sized city, and it wasn't even 10 o'clock, there seemed to be absolutely nobody between here and there.
Where is it again? Ernst asked.
You can see the sign, man, the guy said, exasperated. That's why I'm over here. You can hear the music a block away.
Ernst nodded. If he made a run for it, and no cars ran him over while he crossed the streets, it still seemed unlikely he'd make it to the dance club before the creature got him. It had made it through the partition and a locked door at the convention center, and always seemed to know where Ernst was. What were his chances he could escape it now? But by that same token, why did he keep moving? Why not just give up and let the damned thing grab him? Alonzo Moss didn't have to look over his shoulder anymore, did he? Maybe he could just stay with the homeless guy, sit right next to him the whole night, be a vagrant for a few hours, at least until the sun came up. That could work. He could offer the guy $5 to let him sleep in the bushes a few feet away from him.
Quiet as a mouse. You'd never know I was here, and all that.
But what happened when the homeless guy fell asleep? Did the magical protection of being with another human being still hold up once that person was unconscious? Or would the monster figure, You're as good as alone now, my friend.
Would you show me?
Ernst asked the man.
Walk me over there.
To the disco place? Dude, I'm bedded down for the night, man.
$10. I'll pay you $10 to walk me over there.
The man snorted.
You don't want to go there, man. It's that kind of crap with the beat that, you know, like, hits you. A bunch of kids getting high and jumping around. Not your scene.
$20, said Ernst. I'll pay you $20 for, what, 10 minutes' work.
The homeless guy considered it.
You can make it by yourself. You don't need me. It's 2 blocks. Maybe 3.
Please,
Ernst heard himself say. It sounded like begging. The man paused.
What is it you're scared of, man? Did some asshole jump you?
That's right. I didn't want to say, but...
That sucks, man. They say Utah's nice. The people are stingy as hell, never give no handouts. But nobody's ever bothered me like that. You okay?
There seemed to be genuine concern in the bum's voice, even if he was drunk or crazy or just down on his luck.
I will be, if you'll go with me to this club.
The homeless guy came out from the bushes, standing on the sidewalk next to him.
Okay, but only because I'm, like, a good dude.
I appreciate that.
And the homeless man, leaving his chair and blanket, walked Ernst down the block like a school crossing guard. Only once did Ernst venture a look behind him. A couple youths on skateboards rolled by, and there was the creature, still following, still looking for its moment to strike.
You see somebody?
His guide asked.
Guys that jumped you?
It was only one guy,
Ernst admitted. The man said nothing to that, but Ernst could imagine what he was thinking. Somebody as big as he was should have been able to handle himself against a single mugger or street punk, no matter how old he was getting. Though he shouldn't have bothered, Ernst said,
Believe me, you're better off not meeting him.
Agree with you there,
said the man, and they waited for a light to change.
Okay, that's where we're going to stop for right now. I do apologize for not finishing the whole story. I originally had 3 episodes in mind, but that 3rd episode was just too long when I was editing it, and so you're going to have a 4th episode, and it will be shorter than the other 3. Hopefully you're cool with that. But let me continue on. Big Ankovich will often make fun of me because I write stories and then I forget that I wrote them. But that has been the case since I was a teenager. It's just part of schizophrenia or something, you know, of where my mind goes when I'm writing versus something else. And there are parts... So I listened to some of this to give me ideas of what to talk about. I was trying to determine where to end the 1st episode, the 2nd episode, and then, well, obviously you end the 3rd episode with the end. But I didn't know where to break it up, and I originally was going to have the first section end right before Ernst met his fans, right before the Q&A. But I decided it was stronger to end after we'd heard about the curse. So, because the tone changes a little bit when you hear about the curse. And so I ended there, and then the 2nd section, it was easier to just end there, because once it becomes a horror story, you can break it up in any way that you want to, really. But I was listening to it, and a lot of it felt unfamiliar to me, even though I had written it, then done like a second draft, then done the audiobook reading, and then edited the audiobook reading. So that's 4 passes, right? There were still parts that were only vaguely familiar to me, and then there were a couple parts where I was like, oh, okay, that's interesting. I didn't remember that. But yeah, there were a couple of moments at the convention where it didn't feel like something I had written, where it felt like something that I'd probably make fun of if somebody else wrote a story that took place at a horror convention, and Tobin Bell from the Saw movies walked by, I'd be like, that's stupid. And I mentioned somebody trying to get a lock of Danielle Harris's hair, which I don't think is as stupid. And, you know, that's just my personal opinion. I hope that you didn't think that it was stupid. But it's difficult to write something that will be amusing or will be scary or will be moving. Those three emotional reactions that you want from an audience. Or romantic, I guess, is the fourth. There are probably other examples, too. But anyhow, I didn't know if it worked or not, if the story was working or not. And now that we're in the third part, I wanted to talk a little bit about the inspiration for the story. And obviously, as I said in the first part, going to that horror convention in 2002, I think it was part of it. But the big inspiration for writing this story in the first place was It Follows. I will talk more about that later on. The most important moment in the story is when Ernst is signing autographs and he looks up and he sees something that is obviously not a person in a costume, but a creature, a supernatural being. And I listened to that bit today, and I wasn't sure if it worked or not. That's the most pivotal moment of the whole movie. And I keep calling it a movie. In my mind, this would have worked as a screenplay better than it does as prose. I wanted it to be a movie. It was a succession of images in my mind rather than prose. And the first image that came to me is him signing autographs and looking up and freezing. And you wouldn't do a close-up on it. You would do a medium shot where you can see like 15 people in the line and something else in the line. And hopefully the scare to the audience is that it's not over the top. It doesn't hit you over the head. It's not a jump scare. It's a moment where 50% of the audience sees it, notices it, and goes, ooh. And the people next to them go, what? What was it? Because you cut back to Ernst's sort of puzzled expression. And then you do a reverse shot a little tighter, and maybe you change the lighting so that more light falls upon this thing in the line. If you do it well, if you do it right, you get two scares out of it. The first is just a subtle, oh, there, what is that? The second is a much better shot of the thing where you know that it's not right. You know that it's a being rather than a person. And the people that didn't notice it the first time notice it this time. That's a tightrope, guys, that you're walking of trying to scare the audience. And it's made even worse or more difficult because this is not a film. I can see it in my mind. I see what I want in my mind. But I'm trying to describe it in prose, the visual, the thing that would be conveyed in a movie. I don't know if that makes sense. Dang, I said it.
I don't know!
I'm not sure if that makes sense. There was a story of mine that we ran on the Dune Steve where I was really worried about the tone. Oh, it was Say Uncle. I wanted it to be a straightforward science fiction story with emotional resonance in it. But the fact that it was a child, a baby, basically, speaking as an adult opens things up for comedy. And I was worried that I hadn't stricken the right tone.
as far as balance between seriousness and a comic scenario. And this, I guess, is similar in that, let's say that I was making a movie about it, and you have Ernst Hillerman signing a woman's breast, which is inherently funny because of his awkwardness and the fact that a line just keeps forming. And see, if this were a real movie and you really had Tobin Bell there, like two booths over, wouldn't it be funny if Tobin Bell frowned at the four people that are in his line versus the 27 people that are in Ernst's line, even though Tobin Bell is a real actor who's done more movies than just the Saw franchise? Ernst is a guy who's never done anything, you know? But all these people want his autograph. And part of it is that, you know, he's not going to charge for autographs. And everybody wants something free. That is mildly comic. I can see it in my head. Ernst's, like, exasperation. Not exasperation. Befuddlement, maybe. That so many people care. And it's funny, but it should also be touching. If you've got a likable guy like John Goodman playing Ernst, you know, somebody who is affable and decent and not cynical, not a bad guy at all. And all these young people, not all, I guess if the movie came out in the 80s, when was it, 87? Then most of the fans of the movie would be my age. They'd be middle-aged. They'd be like the lady who wanted him to sign her boob. And I've been to these cons where somebody like Heather Langenkamp or Kane Hodder or Jamie Lee Curtis are there, and these people love them. And maybe you, obviously you know who Jamie Lee Curtis is, but maybe you don't know who Heather Langenkamp or Kane Hodder are. These are people that think that they are a level above just people. In the same way as I felt the first time I met Stan Lee, and it's like, this guy created so much that has given me joy throughout my life. He's not a man, he's something else, kind of thing. The idea that somebody, that a stranger, thinks that you are that is crazy. But it's also really moving and impressive. And, you know, if I had to do another draft of this, I'd probably put in some imposter syndrome here. Although they're really, it's there. And yeah, I would have Ernst's pocket fill up with $20 bills. Even after he's taken the sign down, people give him money for his autograph. And they say, you know, I got four things signed. Is that $80? And he's like, no, it's nothing. And they're like, well, nothing. And they still give him a 20. And then they walk away and they are happy. It's funny. I started out this by saying, you know, that there are parts that just didn't work. And I felt embarrassed. And I thought, this sucks. And now here I am getting a little bit emotional, not like creepy emotional, but over the story, over the idea of this guy discovering that he is loved. And that is inspired by going to these cons. And I always, if you ever listen to the Delusions of Grandeur podcast, I always talk about the very first autograph session that I went to in 2002 at the second Star Wars celebration, and how there were all of these, a lot of them weren't even actors, puppeteers or day players, or they were extras that got to be in an uncomfortable costume in 1982 or before then. And now there are people lining up to pay to get them to sign a picture of them in that costume. And it was moving to them to hear fans say that their work meant something to them. Their character meant something to them. And it was moving to me to see them moved by fan adoration. And so that really helped inspire this story, which is a dumb horror story, I suppose. I wish I were a better writer, and I could convey what I'm feeling right now into this story. Today, I was listening to it, and I discovered a part where the audio cut out, and I went back to the original recording, which is on my desktop computer, and it was always there. There was always a section of silence, of probably something that happened with a little hiccup in my desktop when I was saving the audio, saving it as an MP3, and I sat down and I re-recorded that sentence, and then I thought, you know, I'm going to put in another little bit here. And I ended up writing about half of a page. This is in 2022. You know, re-recorded that bit and then saved it and then was going to splice it in seamlessly into the audio. And I realized that instead of an uncompressed wave, I had saved it as a low-quality MP3, not even a high-quality MP3. And I thought, well, I'll listen to it, and if it sounds terrible, I'll record it again. But you could tell the difference in the audio. But I didn't think that it sounded so bad that I was willing to record it again. And so I just threw it in there. But part of me was just like, you should do this with the whole book and go through and expand and come up with new scenes and new jokes and new lines of dialogue and maybe a couple other scares. And that's, you know, what I've come to consider George Lucas syndrome, where nothing is ever good enough. You always find things that you want to change and fix and tinker with. Maybe every artist feels that way, you know. There's always room for improvement. But like I said, I wish that I were a good enough writer that the way that I want the audience to feel is how they feel. The reader, the listener. I said way back in the very first episode in March that I recorded, I'd love for somebody else to make a movie of this and take the things that they think work and focus on them and toss out the things that don't work. Although it's a short enough story that you could make a movie of it, an 89-minute, 95-minute, 101-minute movie of it, and not lose hardly anything. You know, Stephen King's novellas adapt to movies much better than his novels do or his short stories do, where you have to either expand them or compress the hell out of them to get a 2-hour movie from it. So besides the convention that I went to, the other biggest influence on this story, the biggest inspiration that I took, was a horror movie that I saw a few years back called It Follows. It was a 2015 horror movie. Everybody says it's 2014, but it didn't come out till 2015. So why do you call it 2014? Huh? Ask yourself that. Why don't you ask yourself that? I only ever saw it once, but it made this huge, huge impact on me. Essentially, it was in some ways, it felt like a morality tale. It was avoid casual sex, folks, story where this girl hooks up with this guy and gets a supernatural STD from him. She hooks up with this guy, and then she sees this creature, I guess, monster. That's not really a monster. I mean, it's just a witch or a woman ghoul kind of thing. And it comes after her. And it makes me want to watch it again tonight so that I could know what I was talking about. Like I said, I only ever saw it once about 7 years ago. And there was this image where the girl, I feel like she's looking out a window of a building, or she's in a parking garage and she looks out and sees this being stalking toward her. And it's a fairly far away shot, and it's just really, really wrong. The wrongness of it is what scared me so badly. She doesn't know that this has happened now, that she's gotten this STD, right? She just knows that something is after her now. And no matter where she goes, it comes to get her. And unless she passes the STD on to somebody else, it will kill her. You know, I think I'll check tonight to see if it's available on streaming or something. It was a movie that I liked so much and then never saw again that I'm worried that if I did see it a second time, it wouldn't have the same impact on me. You've had that happen, right? Where you see a movie that was beloved to you as like a child, or the night that you saw it, or the person that you saw it with made it special. And then you watch it again as an adult or out of that relationship, or just under different circumstances, and it's not as good. The magic isn't there. My cousin is one of the few people that really liked The Rise of Skywalker. And he always says that he's afraid to watch it again. He saw it opening night with me and then never saw it again. And he's always afraid to watch it a second time because what if everybody that says that movie is terrible is right? And he can't enjoy it the second time that he sees it. He would rather have the memory of really liking that movie and saying, yeah, the sequel trilogy ended on a high note, than watch it again and be disappointed. I get that. You know, every once in a while, there's a movie that's the opposite of that, where you didn't like it so much the first time you see it a second time. It's like, wow, hey, this was really good. People were right. That almost never happens for me. Almost never. It's going to be the other way around much more often than not. But even if I saw It Follows a second time and it was terrible, the image of the girl looking and seeing the being walking toward her was a visual that seared itself into my brain enough that I wrote this book, Newfound Fame, inspired by that visual. And if they made a movie of this, I keep saying that, I wonder if people would pick up on that and say, oh, you know what? That's a ripoff of It Follows. I don't personally feel like it is a ripoff of It Follows, but it was inspired by it. And that is something that's cool. And it would be great if something that I wrote inspired somebody else, especially if they were very, very successful with the thing that they wrote and the thing that I wrote was not successful at all. Wouldn't that be adorable? It's kind of like when George Lucas asked for the rights to Flash Gordon. You know, he wanted to make a Flash Gordon movie. And whatever studio currently owned the rights, let's say that it was Paramount, said, no. No, we're not going to give that to you. And so he went out and he made Star Wars. And you can bet that that studio, whichever studio it was, that said no, kicked themselves from here until, you know, whichever executive made that decision took their life. And good, rightly so. I hope that you got a kick out of Newfound Fame, that you enjoyed the way that I presented it, my narration, the story, the character, the scenario. Let me know, Ernst Hillerman. And who would you cast in the role if you were making a movie of it? And that's it. Feel free to support me on Patreon. You can give me $1 an episode or more. And it's very, very appreciated. And you get extra stuff that nobody else gets. And you get my thanks. But just between you and me, if you've listened all the way to the end of the episode, well, you will also get my thanks. That's a freebie I will throw in here. Take care. Be careful. Always look behind you, just in case.
This is Fake Sean Connery. And you can support me and the boy over at patreon.com. Encourage us to put out more shows by donating $1 an episode. Or more if you've got more money than sense. Which, I suppose, some people have. And that's it for the Rish Outcast, which is produced under a Creative Commons 3.0 Attribution No Derivatives license, which means Rish owns it. Unless he stole it, and it's free of charge. Unless you paid for it, and Rish has been lying all this time. The music in the show was by Kevin MacLeod of Incompetech.com, also under a Creative Commons license. Special thanks to Gino Morito, who created the logo. Can that be right? Gino? This podcast is over.
Toad's got a wicked tongue, Senator. Like you.
As they used to bury them.
As they always will. As they will bury my father. And me. They say an Okram will not lie in a coffin. They say an Okram will not lie in a coffin. They say an Okram will not lie in an offin. F**k! They say an Okram will not lie. They say an Okram will not lie in a coffin.
If possible, brighter and gayer and sweeter than usual. And I began to think that a little domestic toil was really good for her. Lay a gray marble figure of a knight in full plate armor, lying upon a low slab, with hands held up in everlasting prayer. And these figures, oddly enough, Jesus, I don't know that I've ever done a voice that caused me to throw up before. Okay, I'm going to stop for a minute, because I rolled up the windows, and it is May, and I'm really, really hot here in the car. Give me a break, folks, please. It's like being in a Brown Depths monster suit. I had the air conditioner on, and I kept turning it on higher and higher, because it was just so hot in the car. Finally, I turned it on full blast, and the air that was coming out of the vents was hot. And I was just like, oh no, my air conditioner has gone out. And then I looked over and I had the temperature gauge turned all the way to heat. So yeah, it's not its fault, silly. Hey, there's another outtake for you, kids.
Why not? Why not?
I'm afraid that I mean to eat you.
Oh no. Oh no. I can't do this voice without throwing up.
That's bad.